This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
This is Positive Parenting, and I'm Armin Brott. Why don't my kids do what I say? Who made the mess in here? When will my teen make better choices? Questions like these lead parents to victim thinking, complaining, procrastination, and blame. The solution in this area and pretty much every other area of our lives, whether you're a parent or not, is to bring personal accountability to life within our family. Okay, I realize it's really easy to say, oh, let's bring more personal accountability into life. How are we going to do that? Well, our guest today is going to be talking to us about a method that he's come up with called QBQ, the question behind the question. And that means looking behind questions like, why won't my kids listen and why won't they do what I ask, and finding better ones. Questions like, what can I do differently? Or how can I improve as a parent? It's really tempting to look outside of our homes for reasons why our kids act the way they do at times, and it's easy to make excuses or point fingers at other people or institutions, but how can we expect our kids to live accountable lives if we don't? So the question is, where else are they going to learn to practice personal accountability if not from us? Oh, there may be some other places where they could learn some of these lessons, but the lessons that they see every day from mom and dad are so much more powerful. I'm Armin Brott. We'll start a discussion about the question behind the question when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
I'm the only one in school that can tie his own shoes.
Most kids make fun of me because I still believe in the tooth fairy.
A third of the kids in my 8th grade class drink alcohol regularly.
Over 99% of my class has been offered illegal drugs.
Half of my college classmates binge drink, abuse drugs, or do both. But the frequent dinners I had with my family have helped make sure I'm not one of them.
Learn more about the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University's Family Day at CasaFamilyDay.org. Dinner makes a difference.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is John Miller, who is the author of Raising Accountable Kids, How to Be an Outstanding Parent Using the Power of Personal Accountability. He's also the author of a number of other books, including the QBQ workbook, and we'll be talking about what QBQ is. John, thanks for joining us.
Armin, glad to be here today. Thank you.
So let's talk about personal accountability and what that is and why it's so important and, I guess, why it's lacking.
Well, now that's about 3 days worth of conversation right there.
Okay.
Let's start with what QBQ is all about. The QBQ book, which is the original book. QBQ stands for the question behind the question. And it really came from my research, which I didn't know I was doing, when I was selling management and leadership training for a decade, and sitting in thousands of hours of workshops with really good people. And I would listen, and I finally caught on. It took me a while, but people tend to ask externally focused questions, like, when is that department going to do its job right? And why do we have to go through all this change? And why doesn't someone train me? And when are they going to solve the problem and improve this place? And I remember thinking, there's got to be a better question here. And so one day, I went out to a client group, and I taught them to turn the questions around. And instead of asking those kinds of questions, let's ask the question behind the question. And somebody shortened it very quickly to the QBQ. And that was 20 years ago, Armin, over 20 years ago. And I soon after that left my mentor in the training company that he owned, and I was representing him. And at the age of about 30, I went off on my own to be a keynote speaker, and I started talking about personal accountability and this idea called the QBQ, and I started teaching, let's turn questions around and ask questions that make us look in the mirror, make me look in the mirror and take ownership for problems, for my life, for my results, for my outcome. So I started teaching that, and my career kind of took off as a speaker, and we moved into Denver, Colorado, and I started traveling the country, and what happened was a lot of the audience members, of course, as you would know, would be parents, moms and dads, and they would come up and say, oh, this is great. Do you have it in a parenting format? And for years we didn't, but then my wife and I decided to co-write the book, Raising Accountable Kids, and that's what we're here to talk about today. It all started with teaching personal accountability in the corporate world.
Right. So how does that translate in there? I mean, the questions that you're going to be asking. I mean, certainly you could replace a few words, and it would be certainly questions that we've all heard from our kids about, you know, it's his fault. Why doesn't he ever do this? Or why don't you like me? Or nobody ever listens to me. You know, that sort of thing that we, sure, we all want to roll our eyes about. But how do you begin to even think that there's a question behind the question?
Well, here's the humorous part about Raising Accountable Kids book. When I mention it to a general audience, let's say I'm out keynoting at a corporate meeting and I mention Raising Accountable Kids, I can see it in people's faces, and I've gotten emails that say this. People will say, oh, thank you, John and Karen, a book my 12-year-old can use because I can't get him to do his math homework. Or thank you, Tom Millers, a book I can use to get my teenage daughter to speak to me more respectfully. But what they need to realize is the book is not for kids. The book is for mom and dad to practice more personal accountability. So instead of mom or dad asking externally focused questions that take us to three traps that we can discuss, mom and dad need to learn to ask the question behind the question so they can improve as parents. So just to make it clear, the book teaches a message of accountability and a lot of great content to the mom and the dad. But of course, as we say in the book, modeling is the most powerful of all teachers. So if we want our kids to be accountable, it has to start with the parents.
Okay, so what happens if they are not taking personal responsibility? So there's three traps. What are those?
Well, the three traps that human beings tend to fall into that we've discovered over the years, and none of this is new, but it's nice to just put them in three little boxes. One is victim thinking, and that sounds a lot like, why is this happening to me? Why don't I ever get a break? Why don't people do more for me? Now, in the parental sense, it's like, why doesn't my daughter listen to me? Why doesn't my son open up to me? Why doesn't my spouse, my partner, support me more? The minute I ask why me, I put myself into a victim mode. I'm holding a pity party of one, and I'm really not growing, learning, changing, and making a difference. So the first trap is victim thinking. The second one is procrastination. And that sounds a lot like, when will someone else handle this? When will they take care of that? When will somebody improve this place? When will he or she solve this problem? And then back to parenting, when will my 4-year-old stop doing this? When will my 12-year-old do his homework? The minute I say when, and I ask that kind of a question, I really just said, well, I'm not going to take action. I'm just going to procrastinate while waiting for others to do something. And as we say in the book, the Raising Accountable Kids book, more often than not, it's better for a parent to deal with stuff now and not later. As we tell parents, if you're having problems with your teenager, you probably had problems with your toddler, and all you're dealing with now is stuff you've let grow and fester over many years.
Right, right.
So we have victim thinking, we have procrastination, and then the third trap is blame. And we all know about blame in our world today, but we position the blame piece as when we ask questions that begin with who. Who dropped the ball? Who made the mess? Who missed the deadline? Who didn't do this? Who didn't do that? Who did do that? Who came up with that dumb idea? We hear these who questions
right
all the time. And the minute I ask who, I'm seeking culprits. And the minute I'm seeking culprits, then I'm just in the blame game. And that doesn't accomplish much either.
Right.
So we've taken all this material and we've applied it to parenting. Now, of course, you know, like a mom or dad enters a room and says, who made the mess? We're not saying don't ever ask that question. But hopefully your goal is to teach and raise good, accountable kids, not just to punish. So parents
right
need to be careful in thinking about what is my intent when I ask these questions.
All right, so let's turn these things around a little bit. So what are the more appropriate questions rather than the why is this happening to me?
Sure. Well, one of the key things the book teaches on page 3 or 4, I think, very early, that's why it's always a chuckle for me when I hand them the Raising Accountable Kids book and they say, oh, this is great for my teenager. He needs to read this. No, this is for you, Mom, Dad, because on page 4 we say a statement that many will be challenged by in today's society, Armin, and it's this. My child is a product of my parenting, period. No excuses. It's not society. It's not Hollywood. It's not politicians. It's not the church. It's not the schools. It's not the coaches. My child is a product of my parenting. See, you have to lay in some precepts. And until you build that foundation, you can't be a really effective and strong parent, because if I still think when my child is doing this or that, that it's somebody else's fault, well, you know, he hangs out with the wrong friends, or he picked that up at school, or he learned that at daycare, or you know what, Hollywood sets a terrible example. If I am living that kind of thinking, externalizing and blaming the world, I'm not taking accountability for my child. So one of the wrong questions would be, why won't my child change? Why does he keep doing that? Why does he engage in that behavior? Well, wait a minute. The QBQ would be, what can I do to more effectively communicate with my child? What can I do today to learn new skills? How can I become a more effective parent at this moment? What can I do to either set better boundaries, establish firmer consequences, whatever, build my patience level? See, every time we ask a QBQ, and they tend to begin with what or how, they contain the word I, and they focus on action. So the minute I pause, and that's what the QBQ is, Armin, it's a thought-shaping tool. It allows me to pause, and instead of screaming at my kids, shaming them to the core, getting angry, and having a home full of slamming doors, we can actually pause and say, well, what can I do differently? Mm-hmm. Or maybe even just simply ask, how did we get to this point? Aha, I've enabled my child for 11 years. No wonder I'm now dealing with a running amok teenager.
Now, aren't there going to be times, John, we only have about a minute left in this segment, but aren't there going to be times when you need to instill some personal accountability and by asking, why don't you take more responsibility for this?
Well, the problem with the why don't you is it immediately puts people on the defensive.
Now, okay.
Obviously, we'd have
Fair
to
enough.
Take every scenario separately. But for a parent to stand, and we've seen this, we've all seen this, because we're both parenting coaches. We've seen parents yell at their kids saying, why don't you ever listen to me? Well, wait a minute, there might be a better question in there. What can I do to be a better listener for my child? How have we come to this point where my child doesn't want to listen to me? What can I do to change in my parenting style to build closeness? There's a lot of questions I can ask that cause me to look in the mirror before I go yell at the kids.
We're
not recommending yelling at the kids.
Talking with John Miller, who's the co-author with his wife Karen of Raising Accountable Kids, How to Be an Outstanding Parent Using the Power of Personal Accountability, and also the QBQ workbook, which we'll be talking about a little bit later. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more with John.
Did you know 1 in 3 adults is at risk for kidney disease? If you have high blood pressure or diabetes, you could be the one.
I was looking in the newspaper and saw an article that said if you have symptoms for kidney disease, you should see your doctor. And I really didn't expect anything because I felt healthy. I didn't worry about my borderline high blood pressure. Turns out it was silently inflicting kidney disease. When you know, it's almost too late.
Visit the National Kidney Foundation at kidney.org. Now you know.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, I'm Armin Brott, talking with John Miller, who is the co-author of Raising Accountable Kids, How to Be an Outstanding Parent Using the Power of Personal Accountability. So talk to us a little bit more about these three traps, because I think that they are pretty significant. I think that we as parents have a tendency to fall into them, and certainly kids do. That's probably one of the most common complaints that I hear parents talking about is that their kid, particularly when they get to be a tween, young teen, they don't take responsibility for anything. So how do you begin to instill that into a child during what seems to be kind of a normal developmental stage?
Certainly. Well, we've raised 7 kids. Our kids are 34 down to 18, and our kids are not perfect, just as mom and dad are not perfect. But I think one thing we've done well is a lot of open conversation, a lot of fairness, if you will, meaning we allow our children to have their emotions, but there's also parameters and there's boundaries. One thing we see with parents today is, I'll just say it plainly, we think some of the young parents have turned what used to be good, firm discipline into harshness in their mind. They feel if they're disciplining their child or drawing boundaries on their child or being harsh. And I don't know if that's driven by parents wanting to be their children's best friend or what, but we've noticed a lot of lack of boundaries and parameters for young children. And then, you know, 5-10 years later, parents are wondering, how did we get here? Well, you've been engaging in weak parenting, weak, W-E-A-K.
Yeah.
And we found a strong parent knows how to discipline, they know when to discipline, they choose to discipline. And so a lot of this firmer structure, kids were not born to be in charge. Parents must be in charge. One thing we know is in some homes, the child is in charge. They become the boss. And that happens for a lot of reasons. But if you want to raise an accountable child, which is what we're talking about here, it begins with mom and dad practicing personal accountability. I always ask parents, do your kids complain about their teachers, their friends, their coaches, and school, et cetera? And they'll say yes. And then we'll ask, well, mom, dad, are you complaining about your employer? Are you complaining about grandma? Are you complaining about the neighbors? Modeling is the most powerful of all teachers. So it begins with mom and dad saying, what can I do to be a strong parent? And strong is a positive word, not a negative word. What can I do to build structure that helps my child understand choices and consequences? One last point here. We believe parenting is a learned skill, Armin, a learned skill. Nobody is born knowing how to parent. So the accountable parent, we find, is always looking for new ways to do things and develop new skills.
So, John, what are the benefits of personal accountability? How does that help you?
My wife is well known for saying around this family, how can I trust you with the big things if I can't trust you with the little things? So we're always
I've got to say that is practically word for word what these conversations that I have with my daughter. Like, how can I trust you with a big thing if you can't even tell me the truth, or you won't even tell me the truth about whether you brushed your teeth?
No.
I mean, if it's that bad, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Well, so in the little things, let's just take one of the examples in the Raising Accountable Kids book. Is Maria and her son. Her son was 16, and like all 16-year-old boys, he was dying to get his license. But she said, no, here's a standard. You need to have a B in Spanish. And he had like a C- or a D+. And she was not a weak parent. She didn't give in. Bottom line, the boy knew the structure. He knew the parameters, and he had to pull his grade up. And here was the key. Maria would love to have had her son driving so he could pick up his little sister from dance and all the things that parents, you know, need help with. But Maria stuck to her guns. The boy raised his grades and then got his license. And that's the same as saying, how can I trust you with driving a car if I can't trust you to do your homework and pull your grades up? So that's always part of parenting, is building trust. You mentioned truth, you know, talking to kids about getting them to tell the truth. Well, mom, dad, are you telling your children truth? Are you spinning stuff? Are you lying? Here's the point. My child is a product of my parenting. And the more I practice accountability as a mom, as a dad, as a professional, whatever they witness, as a neighbor, the more our children will become more accountable. The benefit? Wow, life is just a lot more fun when we don't blame, don't whine, don't complain, don't point fingers, don't procrastinate, and just get stuff done. We've got a senior in high school right here, and we've told her, you know, we said, Tasha, we're no longer managing you. We're no longer building you. You are accountable for getting your work done on time, and we've created a child at this point that's quite independent from us. She's doing great in her senior year in high school, ready to move on to college. See, that's a key with parenting. Parenting never ends, but it does change. We move from building our kids to relating to our kids. Some parents never make the leap. We've got parents trying to control their 30-year-old sons. That never works. So parents need to keep growing as the kids grow.
So we've got the question. You're turning things around, and it becomes an I question rather than a you or a they question. But how do you get the information to actually answer the question? Because I think a lot of people would say, you know, if your QBQ is, well, how do I do something different to encourage my child to do her homework? But I don't know what those skills are. I don't know how to answer that question. I know how to ask the question, but I don't have an answer. Where do I get the answer?
We believe the answers are in the question. So as long as I'm asking a whiny question like, why doesn't she ever do what she's supposed to do? Or a blaming question like, who did this? And a procrastination question, when will my daughter grow up? Or whatever. long as I'm asking those externally focused questions, I'm not going to get any good answers. The answers are in the question. So again, the QBQ, the question behind the question. What can I do to become more skilled as a parent? What can I do to better understand my child? That's the structure of the QBQ. Sometimes, though, you just need to have good, straight conversation with the child. You have to dig and you have to ask questions with the child. But also, we need to go and look for some resources. One thing I'm amazed at the younger generation, they're searching for knowledge on Facebook. And we tell people, go to parents with gray hair that you respect and have done well. Sit at their feet and learn from them. Don't be afraid, millennial parents, to go to the older parents, the older generations, and ask, how did you handle this? What did you do specifically in moments like this? There are a lot of resources out there, and they're not all on Facebook. We can actually learn from wiser, more experienced parents who have been there.
That's kind of a foreign idea, though, for a group of people. I hate to pick on an entire group of people, but it sort of seems to be that way with the millennials, who do tend to process their information digitally.
Well, it is funny. Sometimes we'll see our own daughters reach out to their friends on Facebook, and my wife will be sitting there with her laptop in her lap, and she's thinking, I could have answered that. I could have given you some advice in that area. So you're right. It's just something the younger folks do. But that doesn't mean we can't decide and choose to go elsewhere to look for knowledge. The benefits of accountability, you raise accountable kids, and there's a lot less stress in your house. There's a lot less yelling. There's a lot less pain. There's a lot more joy. It's a lot more fun. The relationships are more positive. And by golly, you have kids that are productive. Guess what? They do their homework on time. They get home on time. You don't need to ground your children. You don't need curfews because you've got children who are doing the right things. That's what happens when you're a good, healthy, strong parent. And you're humble yourself. As a mom and dad, you know, moms and dads make mistakes. Sometimes mom and dad have to say, I'm sorry. Those are some powerful words in a relationship. I'm sorry, I was wrong. Mom and dad, we say this to parents all the time. Do not expect your teenager to apologize unless you do. If you never apologize, why would your teenager ever apologize? So it all comes back to how good mom and dad are doing in their job called parenting.
And what do you think is going to be the hardest part for parents to get this implemented in their house? I mean, it seems like a pretty easy, not easy, I should say, a pretty simple thing, which is not going to be easy to do, but to turn it around and say, okay, what can I do to make this a better situation? Sure. Kind of, if you had to distill it down, it's like if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem.
There's a couple of things that come to mind. Number one, we have to swallow our pride, recognize we're not omnipotent. We don't know everything. As I just said, humility is the cornerstone of leadership. We teach that in the book. Humility is the cornerstone of leadership. But the number one takeaway from the QBQ message we found over 20 years is this: I can only change me. Now, we're not talking about at this moment about dealing with a toddler, but as our kids grow, we want greater relationships, more productive relationships, warmer relationships. It's really amazing when moms and dads start to say, you know what? What can I do to change me today? It doesn't mean we don't confront and counsel and teach and set standards and consequences. But when a mom and dad realize they can't make their 12-year-old do his homework, but they can start becoming a more skillful parent, engendering in the 12-year-old possibly desire and motivation to succeed, then the focus is a little less on that 12-year-old who's not doing what he's supposed to be doing and more on me as a father becoming a better dad.
John Miller is the co-author with Karen Miller of Raising Accountable Kids, How to Be an Outstanding Parent Using the Power of Personal Accountability. John, thanks so much.
I've enjoyed it, Armin. Thank you.
It's Practical Polly Radio. I've switched to cooking with healthier oils. So now what do I do with all these tubs of lard? Skinny jeans feeling too tight? A bit of lard on your hips and thighs and those pants slide on like a dream. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils, like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and it's time for a Parents at Play segment. You know, you don't have to be a Game of Thrones fan to know that winter is coming. And when it does, you're still going to want to have fun. Here are some of our favorite options for that in-between time. Double Ditto from Inspiration Play. This is a lighthearted game for as many people as you can squeeze together in one room. The object is pretty simple. One player picks a card and reads it out loud. Topics include things like commands you teach your dog, milestones for teenagers, parts of the human body, things you put on your head, and 396 more. The rest of the players have 15 seconds to write down two answers. When time's up, players take turns reading their answers. If one of your words matches with another player's, you both score a ditto. If both match, a double ditto. Comes with 400 cards and a 15-second timer. It's good for 4 to 10 players or more, who are generally ages 10 and up. Costs under $20. You can get information at inspirationplay.com. Escape the Room, Secret of Dr. Gravely's Retreat from Think Fun. If you liked Think Fun's Escape the Room mystery at the Stargazer's Manor, you'll love this next addition to the Escape the Room phenomenon. And don't worry, more are in the works. Since the basic gameplay, mechanics, and idea, which is get out of the room before time runs out, of Dr. Gravely's Retreat are the same as in Stargazer's Manor, let's talk about a few of the differences. First, the story is a little more complex and sinister, and the puzzles are a little more challenging to solve. Second, you may want to play this with a smaller group, 4 or fewer, of slightly older players, since a few of the puzzles are designed to be done by one person at a time, which means that everyone else has to wait. Whether you're an escape novice or a family of Houdinis, this game is a delight to play and will give you the excitement of freeing yourself from a locked room without the claustrophobia of actually being locked in. It's for 3 to 8 players, ages 12 and up. Costs less than $22. ThinkFun.com. The Max Trax Tracer Racers Remote Control Police Chase from Skulldudgery. Now there is a mouthful. Although you and your racing fan kids will enjoy this Max Trax set during the day, it really comes to life, or more accurately, to light, at night. This kit includes 36 feet of glow-in-the-dark track, track risers so you can adjust the height, lane changers, a jump, and two cars. One's a Mustang and the other's a Camaro. Once you've got the track set up, install the batteries in the controllers and charge the cars, turn off the lights, and get ready to be amazed. The cars themselves zip around the track at a scale speed of up to 500 miles an hour. But the coolest thing is the light trace technology. As the cars fly by, they leave light streaks behind them. Wow! It's for ages 6 and up. Costs about $119 at skulldudgery.com. Trick Shot Sports from Tucker. There's not much to say about the Trick Shot Sports dudes except that they're fun to play with. There are 5 sports: baseball, basketball, football, hockey, and soccer, and they all operate essentially the same way. You hold the figure, pull back a spring-loaded arm, or foot, or hockey stick, or baseball bat, and release it, and smack a sports-themed ping-pong ball. You can set up elaborate ricochet trick shots or compete against other players. There are no instructions, so you can make up your own rules or just let anarchy reign. Although we had a great time with Trick Shot, there are 2 things we'd like to see. Some dudettes a little bit, and some left-handed figures. For ages 5 and up, more information at TrickShotSports.com. You'll find reviews of a lot more toys and games to do with your family at ParentsAtPlay.com, and we'll be back next week with another segment for you. But don't go yet, because as you know, there's a whole other half of the show coming right up, and you're not going to want to miss any of it.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Salagadoola, Metricaboola, Bibbidi-Bobbidi.
You must be your fairy godmother. Yes.
It doesn't take a fairy godmother to tell you that the right fit means everything.
Good heavens, child. You can't go in that.
Children under 4'9" need to be in a booster seat because they aren't ready for adult safety belts alone. Many parents miss the important step of booster seats.
Maybe you better explain things to him.
Booster seats raise your child up so that a safety belt designed for adults will fit and protect them properly.
Oh,
That does make a difference.
Remember that 4'9" is the magic number. And get your little pumpkin there safely in a booster seat.
Hop in, my dear. Oh, thank you.
And like Cinderella, you can live happily ever after.
It's like a dream. A wonderful dream come true.
For more information, visit boosterseat.gov. This has been a message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show. Thanks for sticking with us. I'm Armin Brott. Let's get real. Bullying remains a serious problem in many schools today, and holding educator seminars, hanging posters, devising slogans, and creating Twitter hashtags, and even implementing a single preventive program is not enough to make it go away. If only it were that simple. Ultimately, what works to reduce bullying is to consistently rely on a few key evidence-based bullying prevention policies, principles, and practices that are tailored specifically to your classroom or school. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with a well-known child development expert who has spent the past 2 decades researching school bullying and working with over 1 million parents, educators, and students around the world. Now, what she's done is combine the best practices and the strongest elements of bullying prevention programs, and she's put them into something that she calls the 6 R's of bullying prevention: rules, recognize, report, respond, refuse, and replace. Now, more than a program, those 6 R's are actually a comprehensive process that are great for reducing bullying from the inside out and for involving the entire school community. I'm Armin Brott. We'll start a discussion about bullying and, more importantly, bullying prevention efforts and what you can do to create a more peaceful future for students and schools when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
Green light. Hey, girl. School zone. I'm getting hungry. Car changing lanes. You want to meet me for pizza? Stop sign. Intersection clear. Yeah, street. Pizza sounds good. Ball in street? Girl in street!
It's hard to concentrate on 2 things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text, stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at stoptextstopwrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Michelle Borba, who's the author of The 6 R's of Bullying Prevention: Best Proven Practices to Combat Cruelty and Build Respect. Michelle, welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Armin. It's always a pleasure.
It is always a pleasure.
Aww.
So I want to have you start off in the very beginning. I mean, as I was looking through the book, I was being reminded of an interview we did a couple years ago with a woman who was bemoaning the fact that she thought that zero tolerance policies don't work, and that hanging up all these posters all over the place saying, you know, this is a no bully zone and respect and all that those kinds of things don't work, which is completely counterintuitive because schools all over the country and all over the world, as you're saying, are doing exactly that. What's wrong with those things?
Well, she's right. And the reason is that research even proves it. The first thing is the zero tolerance doesn't work because many of the victims are afraid to report, or even bystanders are afraid to report because they don't want to get the kid in trouble, or being thinking maybe he didn't do it. Second of all, what we find out is that it doesn't replace the behavior. In fact, it very often makes a child who's more likely to bully others angrier. And as a result, the child who we want to be able to come back to school, we want to engage, we want to build compassionate mindset, actually becomes the opposite and starts pulling further and further away from that school and community. And the other thing, Marmon, is that they did a fascinating study at Riverside, University of Riverside, where they asked teens and tweens, and tweens are when bullying hits at its highest, what about all of these posters of stop bullying? And the tweens were the ones that said, we don't like it. What do you want instead? Put up there what we stand for. And so the reverse of this is, let's poll all the kids, ask them how many of you support bullying, And then you put up that sign. 99% of kids on this school campus are against bullying. We stand up for upstanders, or we want to be upstanders. And as a result, it actually switches the norm to the school environment.
How does that work? I mean, it seems a little too simple.
Everything sounds simple. Unfortunately, when we're trying to eradicate bullying, it's about changing behavior that are learned. And so it's an ongoing process. It's never a program. And when I wrote the 6 R's of bullying prevention, what I really wanted to do was, above all else, stop the bullying one time forever, but look at what are the best proven practices that will do it. And over again, it says it's not a program. It's a process. It's ongoing. It's not a one-time assembly.
Yeah.
It's not a poster. It's changing behavior.
Well, how do you deal with the missing link here, which is the parents? Because from what I understand, a lot of kids who bully are having that sort of behavior modeled for them at home. And the parents obviously aren't coming into the school to see the posters saying that the kids are against bullying or that other parents are against bullying. How do you get kids to disregard the messages that they're getting so prominently at home?
Well, first of all, what we really are trying to do, and we've always done this, and your show is all about this, is educate parents. So what many schools are doing, and I suggest in it, is ways to involve parents. And there are some very crafty, phenomenal ways that I've seen. I was on Army bases overseas. I walked into a school, and the first thing I saw was a huge TV monitor with PSA announcements that were designed by kids. They were ongoing, and what they were was, here's what the bullying definition is, mom and dad. Here are things that we know will stop bullying. Here's a couple of behaviors that will help us be more caring. That's step one. Anytime a school has an assembly, they may have an assembly. Make a flash drive. Send it home with the child. So part of the homework is describe what you just saw and help the parent begin to adopt the same strategies that the school is adopting. Parent conferences. There's another opening. Yes, you're going to be talking about your child academic performance, but also give them a tip sheet of a parent. Every teacher can do that. Here's 10 tips that will stop bullying. On your website, let's start putting up school website information that also says, here's what bullying is, here's how to report it, and here's the best proven practices that will stop it. It's just simple little ways that we start educating parents, and that'll make a big difference.
Do you think it helps for kids to hear stories of kids who have overcome bullying?
Yes. I think the best ideas that I've seen are, first of all, realizing helping a child who has been a victim, though they don't like to be told that they're a victim. They like to prefer the word target. But it really helps them hear inspirational stories, particularly now celebrities. I love their stepping up to the plate saying, I was bullied, but here's how I handled it. I was just on a major TV show yesterday, and what we did is we spent an hour with kids coming in saying, here's what I did so that I wouldn't become a victim. I told my brother, or I wrote songs, or I kept a journal. And what happened as a result of it, the child began to be more and more resilient because he didn't see himself as being victimized. He saw himself as a way to overcome it.
Wow. Okay. And what about the other side of it? Do you think that it's possible for kids to hear, or probably adults too, to hear from somebody who is a reformed bully?
It's,
you know, that I used to do
idea.
This.
Yeah. Here's what we do know about bullying. I think it's really important, is that there's no one reason why a child bullies. The key for a parent or a teacher or a counselor is to figure out the why. What's motivating the behavior? Is it low self-esteem? Is it I don't have social skills? Is it because he's seen or been coached in it or begins to adopt an aggression mindset? He doesn't have anger management strategies or any and all the above. I mean, there's a number of reasons. Then you design the plan for it. What the problem is a child coming up and saying, I overcame it. The most important thing is, yeah, that's great for a bully, a child who's seeing, hey, I can too. But it's also being realistic that the child who has been bullying also needs to be pulled aside and say, here's what we're going to do to help change your behavior.
All right, so let's talk about some of the 6 R's. And I just should say that the book is theoretically aimed at teachers and school administrators, but there is absolutely no reason why parents and everybody else can't implement some of these rules in our own homes. So the first one is establish an anti-bullying policy and expectations for respect. That the first R is rules. So talk about that a little bit more. So we've been talking about that a little bit. But
we have, and it simply means that whether you're a parent or you're an administrator at a school site or a teacher in a classroom, your first step is to be very clear to your students or your children that we don't permit cruelty. That's not what we're about. In fact, what kids would say, they really appreciate like a little mantra that we're the helpers, not the herders, or we stand in and we speak out when we see somebody who's hurt. But the first step is for everybody to get on board with the same rules and standards and expectations. That would mean mom and dad. That would mean all teachers. That would mean all administrators. The biggest problem with our number one is some people doing it and some people not doing it or sticking up for it. As a result, kids say you're sending mixed messages. Why should I report it if that teacher says it's okay and that teacher doesn't step in to help? You ought to be all on the same page together.
And how easy is that, though?
Oh, it's not so easy if you don't sit down and have a conversation. So the first step in a school is when I go into a school, we sit down and we vote on it. We come up with a clear policy. You have a team that's probably been working on it for almost a year of here's what our values are, here's what our rules are. But do know that 50 states have already signed anti-bullying policies. So the simplest thing a school could do is just go to the state Department of Education that represents your state, start looking at what your rules and regulations are, and then post them. Put them on your website. Get them up there, but make sure everybody's hearing the same message. It's, you know, Armin, it's the same thing in our own home, though. We can say something once. In this house, we don't hit. But unless we continually remind kids of what our messages are, what we stand for, it doesn't make a dent with our kids. It's an ongoing reminder of what we're all about and what we stand for, what our values are.
Do you think you should have signs at home?
Only if it helps. I think the greatest things I've seen parents do is not put up a big sign, but instead come up with what our identity as a family is. And that's just too fun. It's just sitting down one night, putting the kids, everybody's in their pajamas, pop the popcorn and say, what do we want to be remembered for as a family? Then brainstorm a while. What values do we stand for? And the greatest thing I've seen when I talk to kids is that we come up with, you know, we're the caring Perlin family, or in this house, we help, we don't hurt. And so many of the kids said their grandparents actually needed pointed them pillows that had the mantra in it. Or the parent would put up a statement that was on their refrigerator of, we're the caring Perlin family. Or we came up with a little of a hi-fi every day when we walked out of the house. The kids said because we kept reminding each other of who we stood for, pretty soon we became that mantra. And I'm going, how brilliant and simple is that? It's just an ongoing reminder of a family of who we are and what we stand for. Same as a school, same as a classroom.
Talking with Michelle Borba, who's the author of The 6 R's of Bullying Prevention, Best Proven Practices to Combat Cruelty and Build Respect. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking to Michelle.
Bullying is not kids being kids.
It's not about good homes or bad homes.
It's not a normal part of growing up.
I shouldn't be afraid to get on the school bus.
To turn on my computer.
Message. Unlock to my locker.
Did you know that a bully will stop his or her behavior in 10 seconds when their peers speak up?
Use your voice.
Hey, leave him alone.
We have the power to stop bullying.
Find out more at bullying.org.
Where you're not alone.
Dear Mom and Dad, well, the Army has finally seen fit to give me some time off, so I'm writing to tell you that I'm doing fine over here. And Mom, since you asked, if anyone wants to help, just tell them to contact the USO. You can't believe how much they do for us. With love, your son Michael.
The USO depends on the generosity of the American people. To find out how you can help, visit us at USO.org. The USO. Until everyone comes home.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Michelle Borba, who's the author of The 6 R's of Bullying Prevention, Best Proven Practices to Combat Cruelty and Build Respect. So let's move on to the second one, recognize.
Here's a stumbling block. You can't step in and speak out against bullying unless you know what it is. A parent can't report it to an administrator. A teacher can't report it to administrator as well. The biggest mistake is everybody's defining it differently. So the first step is, in simple language, define bullying. And that may mean simply, in this is what it means, kids. It means it's always a power imbalance. It's one child who's picking on another child, or it's a group of kids picking on another child who can't hold his or her own. It's always intentional and deliberate. It's not accidental, but it's deliberate, intentional cruelty, another child or group causing another child pain. Once you get those concepts down, you're going to be more likely to be able to have a conversation about it. You're going to be more likely to be able to report it. And now more likely to be able to have kids step in and say, that's bullying, so stop it. Kids say they don't want to step in if they don't know what bullying is because they don't want to make it worse. Or, you know, disagreements are normal. That's not what bullying is. It's cold-blooded cruelty.
Well, and
that's why we need to define it.
I would imagine that they're also afraid of drawing the attention of the bully to them.
Exactly. Or fear of retaliation. There's a number of reasons kids won't report it. We can get into that one, but certainly fear of retaliation is one thing. But a big thing is kids said, I don't know what it is. If you don't tell me what it is, how can I report it? Or how can I help?
Right.
So it's being very clear what it is and it being very clear so everybody's using the same definition.
And what are some of those other reasons that kids don't report it? So we talked about fear of retaliation or drawing the bully's attention, but what else is there?
Fear of embarrassment and humiliation is key, that they say it's really hard for me to go and tell my mom or dad or the teacher. So we need to be really clear and supportive of that child. But another one that kids say, it really kind of hits us in the heart, is that my mom or dad or teacher didn't believe me. We need to take kids seriously. Or they'll say, don't worry about it, it'll get better tomorrow. When in reality, bullying is usually repeated. And unless we support that child, it can ruin havoc emotionally in that child's life.
So kids need to know, especially, that it's not only physical. I mean, as parents, we're very familiar with the whole concept of cyberbullying and all these other kinds of things. But it doesn't have to be getting a punch in the nose. It can be something that where somebody's 1,000 miles away.
Depending upon the age of the child, the second part we do is that usually the best assemblies or for parents to describe it a child are to role play it or point it out in a book or in a movie. It can be physical, but that's usually for younger children. The most common kind of bullying is verbal, but it's taunting and very, very cruel. Cyberbullying or electronic bullying is anything that happens on your computer, your phone, anything electronic. And the final one that we're looking at is actually called social bullying or relational bullying or exclusion. It's deliberately and purposely leaving somebody out or just starting vicious, horrible rumors about another child who cannot defend their own.
Now, you said that it's essentially in the eye of the person who's the target of the bully. Because I'm thinking that, you know, there is a line between teasing and bullying.
But this isn't teasing. Teasing is usually a child who can hold their own. The child who's being teased can be, you know, you can be friendly teasing and unfriendly teasing, and you're right on that one. But this is a child who cannot hold their own. If you're being teased, you can usually turn to your friend and say, stop it, that hurts, I don't like that. And the kid will go, okay, I'm sorry, and move on. But this is so up a notch, it's so far up to level here, that it's cold and vicious and ongoing taunting, which can be just ruin emotional havoc with a child.
Do you think that there is any place for bullying at all? And I'm kind of wondering about this because I'm just thinking back to my military experiences, and certainly in boot camp, that's really the ground zero for a lot of bullying. And that's used as a strategy.
And it's interesting. You know what, Armin? This is funny because I was hired by U.S. commanders on 18 Army bases, and that's where the bulk of this book was written, was training them. All of the commanders say, enough is enough. We're stopping that. Sure, it's okay to use that strategy up against an enemy, but what we're now looking at is that U.S. commanders are saying, we got to stop this because it's not effective, and there are other more effective strategies.
So what would be an effective strategy?
Well, at that point, being able to boost a child's confidence so that you can just literally go up and hold your own and say, stop it, and cut it out. There are so many different strategies. It all depends upon situations, which is another thing that's really important to keep in mind. Bullying doesn't happen everywhere. Armin, it's situational. It happens in certain situations, in certain locations. So when we look at the third R of bullying on teaching kids to report it, one of the first things we always want to do is I give kids a map of the school and say, would you mark off the spots where you think are hot spots, the places where you feel least safe, and then mark the spots which are cold spots, the places where you feel safest or you can get help. And then when we look at the hot spots, we understand that almost in every case, it could be the bathroom, it could be the back of the school bus, it could be a big cafeteria.
Yeah.
Kids always say it's because there aren't enough eyes. I said, what do you mean by that? This is there not enough adults. The simplest thing that we can do at a school, and this is proven, to reduce aggression is to boost adult visibility in the spots where kids don't feel safe. And automatically, it'll stop a lot of the learned aggression so kids aren't getting away with it. A lot of kids who bully are just getting away with it. They're not the entrenched, cold-blooded, up five levels of a bully. They're just trying it because they can, and the more they try it, unfortunately, they begin to see this works.
All right, so let's skip ahead to refuse. We're not going to get to all six, but I want to get some of the high ones. Help targets refuse provocation and cope with victimization. What do you tell kids who are already targeted about the things that they should be doing?
Well, the most important thing on this one is that we teach kids a number of strategies and help them realize that, first, you didn't do anything to cause it. Once a child realizes that he wasn't the one that he didn't do anything to cause this pain, he feels a lot better. So number one is, we look at thousands of hours of footage. If there's one tip for a parent, it's this. When we look at the kids who are most likely to be picked on and bullied at a school site, what we find is that when we review the footage, it has nothing to do with what they look like, what they said, but how they stand. So the first step to helping a child develop that ability so they're less likely to be refused, or at least be able to speak up, is help them learn strong body language. I teach kids, always look at the color of the talker's eyes. So there's some kids that can't. If you're on the spectrum, that's very difficult, so we revert it and do some other things. But if you always look at the color of the talker's eyes, Armin, and you're actually holding your head up, and the first step is strong, confident body language. Then what we do is we sit down and we brainstorm one-on-one with the child some ideas that are comeback lines. Kids say they really appreciate in the here and now, what are some things that I can say if I feel comfortable to saying that if I say it assertively the first time, I'll be less likely to be picked on the next time. Some of the simplest ones are stop it or cut it out. So we teach calm, C-A-L-M. C is stay cool, because bullies like it when you're upset. Stay cool, that's hard to do. A is assert yourself with a comeback line, like cut it out or stop it, but it's a rehearsed comeback line. L is look the kid in the eye when you say it, because a lot of times you can say it, but if you're looking down, it's not going to go anywhere. And M is make your voice sound like you mean it and it's firm. We practice it over and over and over again. Naturally, we layer it. So the first step is helping a victim learn anger management strategies and cool down strategies. And we, as a result, this child becomes more and more confident, because now he has the skills to be able to handle life, not only in the classroom and school and home, but later on in the workplace as well.
We only have half a minute left, but just real quickly, and this may not be fair to ask you with so little time left, but is there a point where it's okay to hit back if you're being physically bullied?
Yes, I would say so, because if you have to defend yourself and there's nobody else to defend you and you're getting slaughtered, and physically hurt, then yes, do hit back. The problem is, Armin, is that there are many schools who have zero tolerance for it. So what I'm seeing over and over again is the child who hits back is the child who gets suspended, and he was the one who was the target. It's unfair.
Shouldn't be laughing at that.
But I get it, because it's just very, very sad. Bullying is learned. It can be unlearned. What I'm trying to do is put together the best proven practices that adults, when we work together, can start implementing in our homes and our schools and make a difference so that kids, when they go off to school, can do what they're supposed to be doing, learn, feel safe, and be able to connect with kids.
Michelle Borba is the author of The 6 R's of Bullying Prevention, Best Proven Practices to Combat Cruelty and Build Respect. Michelle, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.